The National Broadcasting Company presents Great Plays. This Sunday, as its 17th production in this year's Great Plays series, the National Broadcasting Company had intended to bring you The Mikado by Gilbert and Sullivan. Instead, we will play for you today the first radio performance of Sir Arthur Wing Pinero's The Thunderbolt, written for the English stage in the year 1909. Before starting the play, we call to your attention the Great Plays Drama Guide, which is available to our radio audience at the cost of 25 cents. Large numbers of listeners have taken advantage of this guide, and it has greatly increased their pleasure while listening. There are still many more performances to be given in this series, and listeners who have not as yet obtained their copy of the guide will find it worthwhile to do so. Send coin or money orders for 25 cents to Great Plays, National Broadcasting Company, New York City. The guide contains a summary of the plot, a sketch of the author's life, and interesting facts about each of the 30 plays of the series. Imagine for yourself a large, oblong room furnished as a library, without any particular refinement of taste, but furnished in a rich and massive manner, one which irresistibly suggests that flamboyant, yet oppressive style so popular during the last decades of the 19th century. Imagine for yourself this room, for it is the scene of the first act of Pinero's Thunderbolt. The house of which this library is a part does not belong to any of the 7 ladies and gentlemen seated here so solemnly now. It belongs, or belonged, rather, to Edward Thomas Mortimer, a wealthy Midlands brewer, recently, very recently, deceased. The men and women who sit here before us are Mr. Mortimer's next of kin. Their attendance, we may say, should not be ascribed to motives of love and devotion. A far more simple and immediate motive prompts it. Mr. Edward Thomas Mortimer apparently died intestate, without making a will, that is. And according to the common law, the respectable ladies and gentlemen in this room may hope, therefore, to share equally in the very large estate he left. For purposes of the record, Mr. Valance, their solicitor, is at this moment identifying each.
Edward Thomas Mortimer, Lynchpool, brewer, deceased. Died June the 20th. Now, you, sir, are his brother, James?
James Henry Mortimer. I have an old Claybrook Road in Victoria Yard, Singlehampton. Builder and contractor. A parish guardian and a rural district councilman. 8 years treasurer of the Institute and one of the founders of the Singlehampton and Claybrook Temperance League.
James Henry Mortimer, Ivanhoe, Claybrook Road, Victoria Yard, Singlehampton.
And while the solicitor, Mr. Valance, is copying down the full name, address, and profession of this paragon of middle-class respectability and achievement, we have a moment to observe him more closely. James is a burly, thick-set man, 55-ish, say, with iron-gray hair and beard, and with a crepe band around his sleeve.
My brother Stephen was one of the founders of the Temperance League, too, weren't you, Stephen?
Quite so. I'm Stephen Philip Mortimer, sir, 11 The Crescent and 32 King Street, Singlehampton. Printer and publisher, editor and proprietor of our Singlehampton Times and Mirror, and author of the history of Singlehampton and its surroundings, with ordnance map
Stephen
and...
Stephen Philip Mortimer, 11 The Crescent, and 32 King Street, Singlehampton.
Yes, that's Stephen Mortimer, next in line of age to James. 49 he is, bald, stooping, with red rims to his eyes, wearing spectacles.
And you, madam, are a sister of the late Mr. Mortimer?
Rose Emily Rackstraw Ponting. My mother was a Rackstraw. I'm the wife of this gentleman here, Arthur Everard Ponting. West Sussex Regiment, Colonel retired. 17A Coningsby Place, South Belgravia, London.
Rose Emily Rackstraw Ponting.
Rose, a lady of 44, fashionably dressed and coiffured. She's relaxed on the settee now, fanning herself.
And that, Mr. Valance, is the lot.
No,
there's... Oh, there's Tad. Daddy, it's John Mortimer.
Don't forget me, Jim. 6 Nelson Villa, Singlehampton, Mr. Valance. Professor of Music.
Thank you, Mr. Mortimer. I'll just put that down.
Yes, that's Tad. James almost forgot. Thaddeus Mortimer, a meek, careworn man of 42. A man easily overlooked in affairs of this kind. His wife, Phyllis, sitting over there beside him, looks careworn and withdrawing, too. Obviously, this professor of music has not achieved success in the world as his brothers have. And he looks something like an apologetic specter beside the short, stout, apoplectic figure of Rose's husband, Colonel Ponting, sitting across from him. But Mr. Valance, the solicitor, has finished with his writing, and James demands his attention impatiently.
Are there any further particulars you'd like to have, Mr. Valance?
One or two, Mr. James. I understand, sir, that those members of the family here present and the deceased Mr. Mortimer had not been on speaking terms for some years. There was some estrangement, I believe.
Indeed, sir. But then we had a letter from Mr. Elkin. He's poor brother Ned's solicitor, you know. Telling us that Ned was seriously ill and saying that he was willing to shake hands with the principal members of the family if they chose to come through to Lynchpool.
Thank God we came.
Thank God.
It'll always be a sorrow to me that I didn't get down till it was too late. I shall never cease to reproach myself.
Oh, well, you're a woman of fashion, Rose.
Well, still, if I had guessed the end was as near as it was, I'd have given up my social engagements without a murmur. Toby, wouldn't I have given...
Without a murmur. Both of us would.
And now, I think it would perhaps be as well that I should meet Mr. Elkin.
He's gone round to the safe deposit company in Lemon Street.
His latest idea is that my brother may have rented a safe there in which he deposited a will.
Preposterous! Never heard anything more grotesque.
The old gentleman may want to drag the River Lynch next.
Well, you must remember, gentlemen, that it's the duty of all concerned to use every possible means of discovery of such a will.
Here is Mr. Elkin now, Mr. Valance. Come in, Mr. Elkin. We are waiting for you, sir. Mr. Valance. Craik and Valance Singlehampton, our solicitor.
How do you do, sir?
Any luck?
Luck?
In Lemon Street, Mr. Elkins. Did you find anything?
No. There is nothing there in your brother's name. It was worth trying.
Aye. It was worth trying.
Everything's worth trying.
Everything. Mustn't leave a stone unturned.
No will. This is a puzzling state of affairs, Mr. Valance.
Oh, come, Mr. Elkin.
I don't want to appear uncivil to these ladies and gentlemen. Very puzzling.
Scarcely what one would have expected, perhaps, but what is it that's puzzling about it?
People have died intestate before today, Mr. Elkin.
I might have agreed with you until a few days before his death, last Saturday. It wasn't until last Saturday that he first spoke to me about this child of his.
Child?
This young lady we're going to see presently, Mr. Valance.
Oh, I haven't heard anything of her.
Bless me, haven't you been told?
We hadn't got as far as that with Mr. Valance.
Mr. Elkin did not think it fit to inform us of her existence till yesterday.
12 o'clock she's due, isn't she?
You fixed the hour yourself, Mr. James. Unfortunately, she's been away visiting.
She's studying painting at one of these art schools in Paris.
And didn't arrive in Lynchpool until late last night, Mr. Valance. Mrs. Elkin and I received her. Only 24, a nice girl.
Is the mother living?
No.
The mother was a person of the name of Thornhill.
Calling herself Thornhill. Some woman in London. She died when the child was quite small.
This meeting with the family is my arranging. As matters stand, Miss Thornhill is absolutely unprovided for, Mr. Valance. And there was the utmost affection between Mr. Mortimer and his daughter, as he acknowledged her to be himself. Now, you won't grumble at me for my use of the word puzzling.
Well, I'm sure my clients, should the responsibility ultimately rest with them, will do what is just and fitting with regard to the young lady.
More than just, if it's left to me.
We should only be too anxious to behave in a liberal manner, Mr. Valance.
Well, I suppose we should have to make her an allowance of sorts, shouldn't we?
Yes, but this art school in Paris, no conception what that kind of fun runs into.
Schooling doesn't go on forever, Colonel.
But it'll lead to an atelier, studio, if you're not careful.
Oh, the art school could be dropped, surely.
Perhaps the art school isn't strictly necessary.
And she has an address in a most expensive quarter of Paris, didn't you say, Jim?
Aye, the Colonel says it's a swell locality.
Most expensive. The father, if he was her father, seems to have squandered money on her.
Well, we shall see what's to be done.
Squandered money on her recklessly.
Yes, we'll see, Colonel, we'll see.
I beg your pardon.
Well, Phyllis.
I beg your pardon, with every respect for Rose and Colonel Ponting. If we do come into Edward Mortimer's money, we mustn't let it make an atom of difference to the child.
We mustn't, Phyllis.
He was awfully devoted to her in his lifetime, it turns out. Colonel Ponting and Rose, did ought to remember that.
Thank you, Mrs. Thaddeus Mortimer.
Phil.
Jim, Stephen, you couldn't stint the girl after pocketing your brother's money. You couldn't do it.
Blessed if I've ever been spoken to in this style in my life.
Jim, listen. If we come into Ned's money, we come into his debts into the bargain. A girl's a debt, a big debt, as it were. Whatever Ned could afford, we could amongst us. Why he should have neglected to make Miss Thornhill independent is a mystery, but, well, I'm with you there, Mr. Elkin. This is certain. If it falls to our lot to administer to Ned's estate, we administer not only to the money, but to the girl, and the art school, and her comfortable lodgings, and everything else in reason.
Aye. I must be leaving. The young ladies from Roper's are waiting to fit me with my morning clothes.
I'll see you out, old girl.
And, Mr. Elkin, yes. Shall we have a little talk together in the other room?
Oh, by all means, Mr. Valens, yes.
What have those two got to say to each other on the quiet in such a deuceable hurry?
My dear good friends, I beg you won't think me too presuming.
Oh, what is it, Colonel Ponting?
But you mustn't. You really mustn't allow yourselves to be dictated to. Bullied.
Bullied?
Yeah, bullied into doing anything that isn't perfectly agreeable to you, Mr. James.
Do you consider we're being bullied, Colonel?
First, you have Mr. Elkin, a meddlesome, obstructive...
Quite right,
oh, he's
quite
obviously
right.
Antagonistic to us, obviously.
Of course he is. He snips a little job of work over this, Miss Thornhill.
By George.
And then you've got Mr. Valance, your own lawyer.
I'm a bit disappointed with Mr. Valance.
Dogmatizing about what's just and what's fitting in connection with this... this girl.
Here he is, Colonel.
And finally, to cap it all, you have your brother, Thaddeus. Your brother.
Yes. Chad obliged us with a pretty stiff lecture, didn't he?
Well, it was Phyllis who began it. She's a suitable person to be lectured by, I must say.
Poor old Ted. He was only trying to excuse her rudeness.
Just fancy. The two Teds sharing equally with ourselves. We shall see Phyllis aping us now more than ever.
Mm. Butcher, the wife's father, wasn't he?
Oh, just as bad. Old Burdock kept a grocer's shop at the corner of East Street.
Poor old Ted.
Rich old Ted today, though.
I look not angry with Phyllis.
Angry?
The ladies, Dad, they will make mischief.
Phyllis hasn't the slightest desire to make mischief. She's a little nervy, a little unstrung. That's what's the matter with Phyllis.
There's no cause for her to be specially upset that I can think of. She didn't know Edward in the old days as we did.
No, but being with him on Wednesday night when the change came, that's affected her very deeply, poor girl. She helped the nurse him.
One of the nurses cracked up, didn't she?
The night nurse.
And there's where Phyllis came in handy.
Phyllis hadn't more than 2 or 3 hours of it when all's said and done.
No, but as I say, it was during those 2 or 3 hours that the change set in. It's been a shock to her.
Truth is, Phyllis delights in making a fuss, Dad.
You never liked Phyllis from the beginning, any of you.
They never liked her.
You never cottoned to her, never appreciated her. Oh, I know. Old Mr. Burdock's shop. Well... shop or no shop, there's no better wife, no better woman breathing than Phil.
No, one may like a person without being blind to shortcomings.
However, maybe it won't matter so much in the future. It hasn't made things easier for us in the past, but now...
Henceforth, you and your wife will be above the critical opinion of others, eh, Ted?
Aye, Ted's come into money now. Mind what you're at. Ted's come into money.
My Lord, I hope I have. I'm not a hypocrite, Jim. My Lord, I hope I have. Miss Thornhill, these gentlemen are the late Mr. Mortimer's brothers. This is his sister.
Oh, yes.
I'm the eldest brother. James, I am.
Stephen.
Rose, Mrs. Ponting. My husband, Colonel Ponting.
Yeah.
Thaddeus. My wife, Phyllis, is upstairs trying on...
You're tired, I dare say.
A little.
You weren't in Paris, Mr. Elkin tells us, when his letter...
No. I was nearly 9 hours' journey from Paris, staying with friends at Saint-Étienne. Mr. Elkin's letter was reposted and reached me on Wednesday. I got back to Paris that night.
And had a hard day's travelling again yesterday.
She must be worn out.
Hot weather, too. Most exhausting.
Yes, sir.
And... when did you see him last alive? Ned?
In April. He spent Easter with me. We always spend our holidays together.
The principal business we're here to discuss is, I presume, the question of Miss Thornhill's future.
Oh, no. Please.
No?
If you don't mind, I'd rather my future were taken for granted, Mr. Elkin, without any discussion.
Taken for granted?
I'm no worse off than thousands of other young women who are suddenly thrown upon their own resources. My prospects don't daunt me in the least.
No, no, nobody wants to discourage you.
I confess that I am disappointed. Hurt that my father hasn't made even a slight provision for me. Well, not for the money's sake, but because I meant so much to him, I always believed. He would have made me secure if he'd lived longer, I'm convinced.
Not improbable, not improbable.
But I don't intend to let my mind dwell on that. What I do intend to think is that in leaving me with merely my education... and the capacity for earning my living. He has done more for my happiness, my real happiness, than if he'd left me every penny he possessed.
A very rational view to take of it.
Admirable.
Very admirable and praiseworthy. But we are not to conclude that Miss Thornhill declines to entertain the idea of some arrangement which would enable her to embark upon her artistic career. But...
Yes, you are. I don't need assistance, and I couldn't accept it. I will accept nothing that hasn't come to me direct from my father. Nothing. But I am nonetheless grateful to you, dear Mr. Elkin. To everybody for this kindness.
So be it. So be it, if it must be so.
We don't wish to force assistance upon Miss Thornhill.
On the contrary, we respect her independence of character.
Art. You've been studying painting, haven't you? Will you resume that in Paris?
In Paris? Oh, I shall come to London, Mr. James.
London, eh?
Oh, I live in London. My house will be somewhere for you to drop into whenever you feel inclined.
Thank you.
Often as you like. Often as you like.
And you must call on myself and my wife, too, in Singlehampton.
Ah, and if you come to Singlehampton, you mustn't go away without staying a day or two with us in the Crescent.
I'm sorry my wife isn't here. We should be grieved if Miss Thornhill left us out in the cold.
Oh, your father's musical brother, aren't you?
Yes, Tad.
Well, I promise not to leave you out in the cold. And I can only repeat to everyone that I'm most grateful.
Gentlemen, Mr. Valance and I have had our little talk, and we agree that the proper course to pursue in the matter of the late Mr. Mortimer's estate is to proceed at once to insert an advertisement in the public journals.
An advertisement?
With the object of obtaining information respecting any will which he may have made at any time.
Oh, very good.
Does Mr. Valance really advise that this is the proper course?
It comes under the head of taking all reasonable measures to find a will.
I sincerely hope that no one will think it is on my behalf that Mr. Elkin...
Oh, my dear, these are formal and amicable proceedings to which everybody, we suggest, should be a party.
Everybody.
All right. Go ahead, Mr. Elkin. We are willing.
Why not? Rose?
Oh, yes, certainly.
Then I have your authority, Mr. Mortimer, for acting with Mr. Elkin in this matter.
You have, sir.
Thank you.
They've gone.
Yes, Phyllis?
Yes. I've been waiting on the landing.
Why didn't you come back, my dear? You've missed Miss Thornhill.
Hey, I know.
The very person who we're all here to meet.
I came over nervous. What is she like?
Such an aristocratic-looking girl.
Is she, though? Is she tall?
I'll tell you all about her by and by. What do you think they're going to do now, Phil?
Who?
The lawyers. They're going to advertise.
Advertise?
In the papers to try to discover a will.
I suppose that's just a mere matter of form.
Elkin and Valance say so. According to Stephen, it's simply a lawyer's dodge to run up costs. Anyhow, we mustn't complain where a big estate is involved.
Is it such a big estate?
Yes.
Oh, I can't.
I heard Elkin's managing clerk tell Jim and the Colonel this morning that poor Ned may have died worth anything between 150 and 200,000 pounds.
200,000?
Yes.
Oh, Tad.
Splitting the difference and allowing for death duties, our share would be close upon 40,000.
Oh.
I'd be on the safe side, put it at 39,000. 39,000 pounds.
Oh.
An income of over 1,500 a year. 1,500 a year. Oh. When we die, 750 a year for Joyce. 750 for Sir. Poor old lady. You've gone through such a lot, haven't you?
We both have.
16 years of it.
Aye, 16 years.
Of struggle and failure.
Failure brought upon you by your own wife, by me.
Nonsense.
No, you always call it nonsense. You know it's true. If you hadn't have married me, if you'd have married a girl of better family, you wouldn't have lost caste in the town.
No.
Tan. We'll leave Singlehampton, won't we?
Permanently?
Yes.
Oh, won't that be rather a mistake?
A mistake?
Well, just as we're able to hold up our heads in the town.
We should never be able to hold up our heads in Singlehampton. If we were clothed in gold, we would still be lepers underneath. The curse would still rest on us.
But where should we...
I don't care anywhere. Anywhere where it isn't known that I'm the daughter of a small shopkeeper.
Yes.
The daughter of... Old Burdock of West Street. What time?
Yes, you're right. Nothing has ever forgiven you in the place you're born in.
We'll clear out.
When will you get me away?
Directly. As soon as the lawyers...
Well, oh. What's the matter, Lou?
We're talking as if Ned's money is already ours.
It will be.
Will it? Do you think?
I prophesy. It will be.
A month has gone by since that day in June which we spent with members of the Mortimer family in Edward's library. A solid month, during which Mr. Elkin and Mr. Valance have advertised and circularized with no success. And since all reasonable efforts to discover a will have proved in vain, the time has been set. This afternoon it is for the surviving Mortimers to claim their respective shares of the inheritance. A meeting has been arranged for 4:00, a meeting at which all next of kin will be present, even Mr. Thaddeus Mortimer, and, yes, his wife Phyllis, whom we see before us now. Instead of the excitement we might expect, there is instead something drawn and listless about Phyllis's appearance as she sits here in the drawing room of Thad's cheaply furnished little villa. Helen Thornhill sits beside her, as she has for so many days now, ever since she first came to visit the Thaddeus Mortimers, drawn to them instinctively by their simplicity, their kindness, and their suffering, too. Only this afternoon has she learned of their plan to leave their house and move away from Singlehampton, and she appears genuinely delighted with the news.
Well, I do think it's shabby of you, Phyllis. You and Mr. Tad might have trusted me with your secret. Oh, Phyllis, wouldn't it be glorious if you came to London to live? Or near London, wouldn't it?
Helen, dear.
Yes?
That morning a month ago in Lynchpool, while we were all sitting in your poor father's library waiting for you...
On the Friday morning?
There was a discussion as to making you an allowance, and everybody was most anxious, almost anxious, that you should be placed upon a proper footing.
Mr. Elkin broached the subject the day I arrived. You were out of the room.
Yes, and you declined.
Certainly. I gave them my reasons. Why do you bring this up?
Oh, Helen, I want you to reconsider your decision.
Reconsider it?
I want you to reconsider your determination not to accept an allowance from the family.
Impossible.
Oh, don't be so hasty. Please, girl, listen first. This good fortune of ours, of Tad's and mine, that you've congratulated us upon, I shall never enjoy it.
Oh,
no, I shall not. It'll never bring me a moment's happiness unless you consent to receive an allowance from the family, sufficient to give you a sense of independence.
I couldn't.
And to make your future perfectly safe.
I couldn't.
And, oh, do.
No.
Do.
It's out of the question.
Oh, please, for my sake.
I'm sorry to distress you, Phyllis. Indeed, I'm sorry. But when you see me gaining some small position in London through my work, you'll cease to feel miserable about me.
Oh, never, never.
You don't understand me. My pride. A pensioner of the Mortimer family? I? How can you suggest it? If I was starving, I wouldn't put myself under the smallest obligations to the Mortimers.
Obligations? To the Mortimers? Obligations? Oh, Helen, Helen.
What?
Oh, my dear, my dear.
Why, you're quite ill. Phyllis, your bad nights are taking it out of you dreadfully. You ought to have the advice of a doctor.
Oh, no, please don't send for the doctor.
Well, go up to your room, then, and keep quiet until Mr. Tad calls you. You've a quarter of an hour.
Helen, you're fond of Tad and me. You said yesterday how attached you'd grown to us.
Oh, I am. I'm very fond of you.
And the children?
Oh, yes.
Helen, if you won't accept an allowance from the entire family, please accept it from Tad and me.
No.
$400 a year.
No.
Well, $200.
No.
Oh, we could spare it. We shouldn't miss it, my dear. We should never miss it.
Not a penny.
You shall accept it, Helen.
Phyllis, you're very odd today. You've got this allowance idea on the brain. Now, look here. Don't let's mention the subject again. Or I shall be offended.
All right. Very well.
Oh, forgive me. But it happens to me just the one point I'm sensitive upon.
By George, we've done it at last, old lady. House to let, eh? I believe I'm keener about it than you are now it's come to it. What a sensation it'll cause at Ivanhoe and the Crescent. You know, I'm still for moving to Cheltenham. Cheltenham seems to me to offer so many advantages, and... Well, I say, look at your things on, Phil. We shall catch it if we're not punctual for the meeting. We're almost due, you know.
I'm not going, Tad.
Not going, dear?
No, I can't go.
Aren't you up to it?
stab that girl. That girl.
Helen?
Aye, we're robbing her. We're robbing her. We're all robbing her.
Oh, you've got another bad attack of nerves this afternoon. An extra bad one.
Tad, I've broken down.
Broken down?
Aye, I've broken down under it. I can't endure it.
What?
Your brother, Edward. Your brother, Edward.
Yes?
Everything belongs to Helen.
My dear, the family were prepared to offer Helen.
No, Tad, listen to me. He left every penny to her. He left it to her, do you hear? There was a will.
A will?
I saw it.
You saw it?
I read it. I had it in my hand.
You did?
I did away with it. Destroyed it.
A will? Ned's will? Now, Phil, I wish you'd let me have Dr. Chapman
no,
in.
No.
My dear, we can afford a doctor now if we require
one. Tad, you think I'm not right in the head. Tad, I know what I'm saying. I'm telling the truth. I'm telling you the truth.
A will?
Aye.
No, you're talking nonsense.
Now, you remember the night that there was no night nurse.
Yeah, I remember, of course.
And I was alone with him.
Yeah, I remember it all perfectly.
I was with him from 8 o'clock till nearly 11.
Yeah, till the others came back. That was the night he sank.
Aye, and it was just before the change set in that he sent me downstairs.
Downstairs?
To the library with the keys. His bunch of keys.
Sent you downstairs to the library with his keys?
Aye.
What for?
To fetch something from the safe. The safe in the bookcase in the library.
Well, what did he send you to fetch, dear?
Some jewelry. He wanted to make me a little present of one of them and...
Make you a present?
Aye, the keepsake. Well, it was about 9:30. I was sitting beside his bed, thinking he was asleep, and I found he was looking at me. He said he was sure I was a good wife to you and a good mother to my children. And then he spoke of the jewelry and opened the drawer of the table by the bed and took out his keys and explained to me how to open up the safe.
You went down?
Aye.
And
unlocked the safe, and in the lower drawer I came across it.
It?
A big envelope with my will written upon it.
Well,
I put it back in the drawer and locked the safe and went upstairs with the jewelry. And then I went into the room up to the bed and he was altered.
Ned?
I measured the medicine which he was to have if there was any sign of collapse. And I lifted him up and gave it to him. And then I rang the bell and by the woman from the kitchen answered it. And I told her to put on her hat and a jacket and go for Dr. Oswald. And then I stood watching him and the idea came to me.
The idea...
My head suddenly became very clear. Every word of the argument in the train came back to me.
Argument?
Between James and the others in the train going to Lynchpool on Tuesday.
Oh, yes.
Edward died, who would come in for all his money? Of course, Ned would leave a will, but where did a man's money go to when he didn't leave a will?
To his next of kin.
Aye. After a time, I went downstairs again. I took out the big envelope and I read the will. Everything to some person, some woman living in Paris. Everything I die possessed of to Helen Thornhill, now or later, for, such and such an address, Spinster, absolutely. And she was to be his executrix, sole executrix. That was all, except that he begged her to reward his old servants. His old servants at the house and at the brewery.
Yes.
Just a few lines on one side of a sheet of paper.
Written in his own hand?
I think so.
Well, you've seen his writing since?
Yes, I'm sure, in his own hand.
That clears it up, then. He made his will. Himself.
3 years ago. I noticed the date. It was 3 years ago.
Yes. This clears it up. There was a will. He didn't forget his child. What fools... What fools we were to suppose he could have forgotten his daughter.
Oh, I didn't know. I didn't guess. His daughter. Oh, my God.
Oh, don't.
Oh, no.
Don't, old lady, don't. Let's think. Oh, let's think now.
No.
Oh, you'll have to write down. To write down carefully. Phil.
Oh, no.
No, don't, dear. Don't. Phil. Perhaps you didn't destroy the will. Not... Actually,
but
destroy it.
I did.
Oh,
I'm afraid it's a rather serious matter. But I did destroy it. I kept it till you left me at Roper's on the Thursday morning, and then I went on to the Ford Street Bridge and tore it into pieces and threw it into the water.
I'm afraid it's rather a serious matter to do.
We've got to go through with it now.
Yes, I got to go through. Yes. What a difference it'll make to everybody. Not only to Helen.
Oh, they'll curse me. They'll curse me more than ever.
What a difference to us.
To us and the children.
Yes. Well, when the affair's settled, we'll still carry out our intention of leaving the town.
Leaving the town? Oh, my Lord. We shall have to leave the town.
Oh.
Leave it as beggars and outcasts.
Yes. We shall have to leave the town now. Yes. Well, they're waiting for me now, James. The meeting was called for this hour. Yes, of course. Goodbye, dear. I'll go up.
Look here. I don't wait another minute for Tad and Phyllis. Not a second.
Yeah, inexcusable of them. Inexcusable.
Mr. Elkin. Mr. Valance.
No, Mr. Valance. No, Mr. Elkin.
Will you, Mr.
No,
Valance?
No, you.
Well, gentlemen, Mrs. Ponting.
Yes,
Mr. Valance and I have to report to you that we've received no communication of any kind in answer to our circulars and advertisements.
Mr. Valance has apprised us of this already.
Order. This is a formal way of doing things in a lax way.
In fact, I've taken every possible step to find or trace a will.
Without success.
Without success.
And I say that the family bears no grudge to Mr. Elkin for doing its duty.
Here, here.
Of course not, of course not.
Why, it's all the more satisfactory, it seems to me, that he has worried around.
The family thanks Mr. Elkin.
We thank Mr. Elkin.
Well, gentlemen, Mrs. Ponting, this is a statement of particulars of stocks, shares, and other items of estate with their values at the death of the late Mr. Mortimer. And a schedule of the debts, so far as they are known to me.
Allow me, Mr. Valance.
What's it come out at?
What did it come out at, Jim?
Jim. I estimate the gross value of the estate, which, as you will see, consists entirely of personal property, at £192,000.
Gross value?
Yes, but what do we get?
Yes, what do we get?
After all, deduction.
Roughly speaking, after payments of debts, debt duties and expenses, there will be about £170,000 to divide. Mr. Valance, will you...
Mrs. Ponting and gentlemen, I advise you that as next of kin of the late Mr. Mortimer, if you are satisfied, and in my opinion you may reasonably be satisfied, that he died intestate, I advise you that any one or more of you, not exceeding three, may apply for letters of administration of your late brother's estate.
Oh, here's Tad. Hello, Tad.
Oh, so you've arrived.
Oh, Tad, where's Phyllis?
Did I say 4 or half past?
Yes. Where is Phyllis?
She didn't feel well enough.
Sit down, Tad.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mortimer.
How do you do, sir?
Good afternoon.
Well, I suppose we needn't go back.
Oh, no, don't let's go. No.
£170,000 to divide.
£172,500 apiece.
Well, the procedure is this. The intended administrator, and I suggest that Mr. James act in that capacity, will make an affidavit stating when and where the deceased died, that he died intestate, a bachelor without a parent, and that the deponent is a natural and lawful brother and one of the next of kin of the deceased.
Mr. Valance.
Yes?
We mustn't go on with this.
I beg your pardon?
The family mustn't go on with this.
Mustn't go on?
What are you talking about?
There was a will.
A will?
He made a will.
Who did?
Edward, he left a will.
What the...
One moment, your brother has something to say to us, Mr. Mortimer. Yes, sir. Well, what about a will? Eh?
I saw it.
What? Saw a will?
I opened it. I read it.
Read it?
I tore it up. I got rid of it.
Mr. Valance, I think we ought to tell Mr. Mortimer that he appears to be making a confession of the gravest kind.
Yes.
One that puts him in a very serious position. If understanding that he chooses to continue, there is nothing to prevent our hearing him.
It happened on the Wednesday night in Cannon Row in Ned's house, the night before he died, the night that we were left without a nurse. Jim and Stephen and I were out and about trying to find a night nurse who'd take Nurse Ralston's place temporarily. About 9 o'clock, I looked in at Cannon Row to see how things were getting on.
You looked in at Cannon Row?
Yes, I went upstairs and sat by Ned's bed, and by, he began talking to me about Phyllis. He'd rather taken a fancy to her, he said, and wanted to give her a memento, a keepsake.
Phyllis?
His wife.
He had some little bits of jewelry in his safe, and he asked me to go downstairs and bring them up to him.
In his safe?
And,
Right, sir. He gave me his keys, and I went down. It was in the drawer of the safe. The drawer.
What was?
A large envelope. The envelope containing the will.
But how did you know?
My will was written on it.
On the envelope? You say you opened it. And inside you found...
Ned's will.
You read it? Will you tell us?
He left everything to Miss Thornhill.
Now keep your seats. Keep your seats, please. Can you recall the general form of the will?
Everything he had died possessed of to Helen Thornhill, spinster of some address in Paris. Absolutely. And he appointed her his sole executrix.
Do you recollect the date?
Date?
Did you observe the date of the will?
Oh, yes, it was made 3 years ago.
When she came of age.
And he asked her to remember his servants, old servants at the brewery and in Cannon Row. There was nothing else. It was very short, written by Ned.
The whole of it? The whole of it was in his handwriting? A holographed will, Mr. Valance, prepared by the man himself.
Tell me, Mr. Mortimer, have you any exact recollection as to whether this document, which you describe as a will, was duly signed and witnessed?
It was signed by Ned.
Yes, but was it signed not only by your brother, but by two witnesses also?
I don't recollect.
He doesn't recollect that, Mr. Valance.
No, he doesn't recollect that.
That's most important, Mr. Valance, isn't it? Isn't it?
You say you destroyed this document.
Tore it up.
When and where? In the room? In the library?
No, out of doors.
Out of doors? When?
When?
You can't remember.
Oh, yes. Sometime between 10 and 11 on the Thursday morning after I left Phyllis. After I left my wife at Roper's to be measured for her black.
What did you do then?
Well, I went to Ford Street Bridge, tore up the paper and dropped the pieces into the lynch.
One more question, Mr. Mortimer. To make your motive perfectly clear to us, may we assume that on the night of June the 19th you were sufficiently acquainted with the law of intestacy to know that if this dying man left no will, you would be likely to benefit considerably?
Yes, I knew.
So that when you came upon the envelope with the endorsement upon it, my will...
Yes.
Have you anything to add, Mr. Mortimer?
Well, one thing I should like to add. With regard to Miss Thornhill, I hope you'll bear in mind that that none of us heard from Mr. Elkin of the existence of a child or a daughter until the Thursday, middle day.
Yes, that is so.
Yeah, doesn't make it much better, only, a girl alone in the world, one wouldn't... No, I've nothing more to say.
And we may take it that your present act, Mr. Mortimer, is an act of conscience purely?
Well, Mr. Valance, what's to be done, Mr. Valance? What we want to know is... What we want to know is, who does my brother Edward's money belong to now? Her or us?
Don't be a fool, Mortimer.
Well, gentlemen, I confess I'm hardly prepared to express an opinion offhand on the legal aspect of the case.
The will's torn up. It's destroyed.
Mr. Elkin.
You appeal to me, gentlemen.
Yes.
And I feel bound to tell you that I shall advise Miss Thornhill, as the executrix named in the will, to apply to the court for probate of its substance and effect.
Ask the court to presume the will to have been made in due form.
Decidedly.
Have you told Phyllis that what you've been up to? Have you?
Yes. Just before I came out. That's what made me so late.
And what does she think of you?
He's dreadfully cut up, of course.
Oh, the jewelry. Oh, she's managed to get hold of some of the jewelry. She shall be made to restore them.
No, Rosie. Phyllis hadn't any of the jewelry, not a scrap. I put it all back in the safe. I swear she hadn't any of it.
Why did you do that?
Well, you see, Mr. Elkin, when I carried it upstairs, I found my brother Edward in a state of collapse, a sort of faint. Phyllis, my wife, she sent me off at once for the doctor.
Your wife, Mr. Mortimer? Your wife sent you off at once?
To fetch the doctor.
Hold on. You didn't go for the doctor.
Yes, I went, James.
Phyllis sent the cook for the doctor.
Oh, yes. Yes, you're quite right. The cook was the first to go.
You followed?
Yes, I followed.
It must have been a good time afterwards.
Yes, perhaps it was.
You said your wife sent you at once.
Well, she told me to go at once. But there was the jewelry to put back in the safe.
What time was it when you got to the doctor's?
Oh, 10, I should say, or 10:15.
That couldn't have been. You were with me then.
Was he?
Why, yes. He and I were at the nurse's home in Wharton Street from 9:30 till 10:00.
9:30?
And we never left each other till we went back to Cannon Row.
No, let's understand.
Yes, yes.
And what's more, we allowed ourselves a quarter of an hour to walk to Wharton Street.
Hello.
Well, it's evident that I'm mistaken in thinking that I went to Dr. Oswald.
Mistaken?
Oh, there's a screw loose here, gentlemen, surely.
Ah, this is most extraordinary, Mr. Valance, isn't it?
It isn't fair. It isn't fair of you to badger me like this. It isn't fair.
Nobody desires to badger you.
Trip me up, then. Confuse me. The will. The will's the main point. Ned's will. One would think, by the way I'm being treated, gentlemen, that I'd something to gain by this, instead of everything to lose. Everything to lose.
Don't you whine about what you've got to lose.
What about us?
Yes, Colonel
Ponting, please.
It seems to me, if my friend Mr. Valance will allow me to say so, that you're really bearing a little hardly on your brother Thaddeus.
Thank you, Mr. Elkin.
What reason, what possible reason can there be for doubting his good faith? Mr. Mortimer is accusing himself of a serious offense. Not defending himself from it.
What we beg of Mr. Mortimer to do, for the sake of all parties, is to clear up certain inconsistencies in his story with his brother's account of his movements and conduct on this Wednesday evening. We're entitled to ask that.
Are you entitled?
Yes, and Mr. Mortimer is equally entitled to refuse it.
Oh,
but I haven't refused. I've done my best.
On the other hand, if he has no objection to her doing so, the person to assist you, I suggest, distressing as it may be for her, is the wife.
The wife, yes.
She ought to be able to satisfy you as to what time he was with her.
By the by, has she ever mentioned this visit of her husband's to Cannon Row?
Never, no.
Never.
Attaching no importance to it, but now...
No. Don't you drag my wife into this. I won't have my wife dragged into this.
Why not?
Why not?
You leave my wife out of it.
Who's your wife?
But anyhow, I do object. I do object to your dragging her into it. I do object.
Mr. Valance asked you just now about your conscience.
I'm not going to answer any more questions.
When did your conscience begin to prick you over this, eh?
You've been in excellent spirits, apparently, this last month. Excellent spirits.
Yes, it's Phyllis who's been ill all the month, not you.
Yes, if it'd been Steve's precious wife who'd come to us and told us this tale. If it had been, one might have understood it.
How long has Mrs. Morton been indisposed?
Oh, a few weeks.
Ever since...
What's wrong with her? What's wrong with his wife?
She's not sleeping.
No, she isn't.
Well, gentlemen, whatever my sins are, I decline to sit still and hear my wife insulted in this style.
Tell us this illness of Mrs. Mortimer's.
My wife's a nervous, delicate woman. She always has been.
Quite so.
And she was upset at being alone with Edward when he swooned.
Although you happened to be in the library a floor or two below at the time.
He might have died suddenly in her arms. She's a nervous, sensitive woman.
And she's been unwell ever since. Mr. Mortimer, how is the lock of the safe opened?
Opened?
The safe in the library in Cannon Row. How do you open it? Is it a simple lock, or is there anything unusual about it?
He gave me directions how to open it.
Tell us.
I forget.
Forget?
It's gone from me.
Gentlemen, you couldn't forget that.
You couldn't forget it.
Mr. Mortimer, are you sure that it wasn't your wife who was sent downstairs to fetch the jewelry? Are you positive that she didn't open the safe?
I know. You mean to drag my wife into this?
You were late in coming here this afternoon, Mr. Mortimer.
Don't you dare. Don't you dare to do it.
Owing, you say, to your having made a communication to Mrs. Mortimer about this affair.
You leave my wife out of this.
Are you sure that you were not delayed through having to receive a communication from her?
Don't you drag her into it.
Are you sure that the story you have told us, substituting yourself for the principal person of that story, is not exactly the story which he has just told you? Mr. Valance.
Yes?
I propose to see Mrs. Mortimer in this matter without delay.
Very good.
Will you,
Certainly.
Mr. Elkin.
Yes?
Stealing a will. Destroying a will. What is it?
What is it?
The law. What's the law?
I'm sorry to have to say, sir, it's a felony.
Oh.
Are you proud of her now?
This is what his merit has ended in.
I'm not in the least surprised.
Old Perdick's daughter.
Thank heaven, my name isn't Mortimer.
Don't you touch her. Don't any of you harm a hair of her head. You've helped to bring this on her. You've helped to make her life unendurable. To bring her to this. She's been a good wife to me. Oh, my Lord. Let me get her away. Mr. Elkin. Mr. Valance. Do let me get her away. Don't you harm a hair of her head. She's been a good wife to me. She's been a good wife.
was broad daylight before my husband and I got back to our lodgings. The document was then in a pocket I was wearing under my dress. Before going to bed, I hid the pocket in a drawer. At about 11 o'clock on the same morning, my husband took me to Roper's, the draper's in Ford Street, and left me there. After my measurements were taken, I went up Ford Street and onto the bridge. I then tore up both the paper and the envelope and dropped the pieces into the water. Signed, Phyllis Mortimer.
You declare that that is correct in every particular, Mrs. Mortimer.
All right, dear, all right. I'm with you, I'm with you. Tell Mr. Elkin. Tell him, is that correct?
Yes.
You've nothing further to say.
Have you anything more to say, dear? I'm here, dear. I'm with you. Is there anything? Anything more?
No, only that I beg Miss Thornhill's pardon. Oh, I beg her pardon.
And
Jim and Stephen and Rose and Colonel Pompey, I beg their pardon.
And I, Mr. Elkin, I wish to offer my apologies, my humble apologies, to you and Mr. Valance and to everybody for what took place this afternoon in my brother's dining room.
Well, Mr. Valance, I think that this lady makes it perfectly clear to any reasonable person that the document which she abstracted from the safe in Cannon Row and subsequently destroyed was the late Mr. Edward Mortimer's will, and that Miss Thornhill was the universal legatee under it and was named as the sole executrix. As I said in Mr. James Mortimer's house, the advice I shall give to Miss Thornhill is that she applies to the court for probate of the substance and effect of this will.
Upon an affidavit by Mrs. Thaddeus Mortimer.
Upon an affidavit disclosing what she has done and verifying a statement of the contents of the will.
Wait. Wait a moment.
Yes, Miss Thornhill?
Wait a moment, please. There's something I want to be told. There's something I want to be told plainly.
What?
Mrs. Thaddeus Mortimer.
Yes?
I want to know whether it is necessary, whatever procedures are taken on my behalf, whether it is necessary that she should be publicly disgraced. I want to know that.
Whichever court is adopted, motion to the judge or action by writ, Mrs. Thaddeus Mortimer's act must be disclosed in open court.
There are no means of avoiding it.
None.
And the offence she has committed is felony, you say? What's the penalty?
The penalty, Mr. James?
The legal punishment.
Well, I think another occasion.
No. No. Now.
Yes. Yes, now.
We'd like to know the worst. Gentlemen.
Bye.
You needn't hesitate, Mr. Elkin. We shall go through with it to the end. Imprisonment, sir?
A person convicted of stealing or destroying a will for a fraudulent purpose is liable under the statute to varying terms of penal servitude or to imprisonment with or without hard labor.
Oh, but this is impossible, Mr. Elkin.
Impossible?
Quite impossible. I couldn't be a party. Please understand me. I refuse to be a party to any steps that will bring ruin to Mrs. Mortimer.
You refuse?
Absolutely. At any cost to me, we must all unite in sparing her and her husband and her children.
If you decline to take proceedings, there is a deadlock.
A deadlock?
As Mr. Valance tells us, it's out of the question that next of kin should now apply for letters of administration in the usual way.
Why? I don't see why. I can't see why.
You don't see why neither of these gentlemen, Mr. James or Mr. Stephen, can make an affidavit that Mr. Edward Mortimer died intestate.
She has no remembrance of a... what's it called?
Attestation clause.
Attestation clause.
Thank you. Only the vaguest notion that there were witnesses. Without them, the will is invalid.
Her memory is uncertain there. But you know, Miss Thornhill, as we all know, that it was your father's will that was found in the safe at Cannon Row and destroyed.
Yes, of course I know it. And thank God I know it. I know he didn't forget me. I know that I was all to him that I imagined myself to be. And it's because I've come to know this at last, through her, that I can afford to be a little generous with her. Mrs. Thaddeus did a cruel thing when she destroyed that will. And it's no excuse for her to say that she wasn't aware of my existence. She was defrauding some woman. And as it happened, defrauding that woman not only of money, but of what is more valuable than money. Of peace of mind, contentment, belief in one who could never speak, never explain, never defend himself. However, she's made the best reparation it's in her power to make. She's gone through a bad time, and I forgive her. I'll go upstairs now, if you'll allow me.
Miss Thornhill, you put us in a position of great difficulty.
And I say again, I don't see why. Where is the difficulty? Let the affair go on as it was going on. Let Mr. James Mortimer and the others administer the estate as they intended to do.
Then you would have Mr. James Mortimer deliberately swear that he believes his late brother died without leaving a will?
Certainly, if necessary. Who would be hurt by it?
Miss Thornhill.
Why? Which do you think would be the more acceptable to the Almighty? That I should send this poor lady to prison, or that Mr. James should take a false oath?
I won't attempt to follow you quite so far, but even then a most important point would remain to be settled.
Even then?
Assuming that Mr. James Mortimer did make this affidavit, that he were permitted to make such an affidavit.
Yes.
Well, what about the disposition of the estate?
The disposition of the estate?
Morally, at all events, the whole of the late Mr. Mortimer's estate belongs to you.
It was his intention that it should be so. Well?
Look here, Miss O'Neill. Sit down a minute. Look here. There's no doubt that my brother's Ned's money belongs rightfully to you.
Mortimer!
Don't you leave... You leave us alone, Ponting, and don't you interfere. I've no more doubts about it, Miss Thornhill, than what I'm sitting here. Very good. Say I make the affidavit, and that we, the family, obtain letters of administration. What then? The money comes to us, still it's yours. We get hold of it, but it's yours. Now, what if we offer to throw the whole lot, so to speak, into your lap?
Jim!
Don't you interfere, Stephen. I repeat, if we offer to throw the whole lot into your lap... Miss Thornhill, we are poor, we Mortimers. I won't say anything about Rose. It wouldn't be polite to the Colonel. Nor Tad. You see what he's come to. But Stephen and me, take our case. We are prominent men in this town, my dear, both of us. We are looked up to as being fairly warm and comfortable. But in reality, we are not much better off than the others. So this is a terrible disappointment to us. An awful disappointment. Aye, the money's yours. It's yours. But what are you going to do for the family?
Well, since you put it this way, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll share with you all.
Share and share alike?
Share and share alike. After discharging my obligations.
Obligations?
After carrying out my father's instructions with regard to his old servant.
Oh, it's a small matter.
A trifle.
Then what it amounts to is this. The estate will be divided into 5 parts instead of 4.
5 instead of 4, obviously.
No, into 6.
6?
6. A share must be given as a memorial to my father, to one of the hospitals in Lynchpool.
Entirely unnecessary. I insist.
Miss Thornhill says that 1 share of the estate's to go to a Lynchpool hospital. Do you hear? That's enough.
£170,000, eh? That's £28,000 apiece.
No.
No.
Eh?
What do you mean, sir?
Well, what do you mean? I don't take my share. My wife and I don't take our share. We don't touch it.
We don't touch it. Oh, no.
Don't be a fool.
Fool or no fool, not a penny.
Not a penny on it.
Very well, then. Very well. Mr. Thaddeus Mortimer will not accept his share.
He declines it? That alters the figures.
Very material.
Only 5 to share instead of 6.
That makes 34,000 apiece exactly.
34,000.
Wait, please. Mr. Thaddeus Mortimer refuses to accept his share. I'm sorry, but he appears... determined?
Determined.
That being so, I ask that his share be settled upon his boy and girl. Mr. Elkin, I suppose an arrangement of that kind can be made easily?
Mr. Thaddeus Mortimer can assent to his share being handed over to the trustees of a deed of settlement for the benefit of his children.
You've no objection to this. They're great friends of mine, Cyril and Joyce, and I hope they'll remain so. Well, you've no right to stand in their light. You won't surely stand in their light. Don't.
Miss Thornhill, Mr. Valance and I have come to the conclusion that as all persons interested in this business are sui juris and agreeable to the compromise which has been proposed, nobody would be injured by the next of kin applying for letters of administration.
Greatly indebted to you, Miss Thornhill. Greatly indebted to you for meeting us halfway and saving unpleasantness. Nothing like a compromise, provided it can be arrived at.
Without loss of self-respect on both sides.
Mortimer, we'll go back to your house. There are 2 or 3 things to talk over, you know.
We shan't be settled in Carla's place till the autumn, but directly we are settled, Well, everybody flocks to my Tuesdays. Let me have your address, and I'll send you a card.
And don't forget the crescent. Whenever you want to visit your father's birthplace, remember my...
The next time you stay at Ivanhoe, I hope you'll unpack more more than one small trunk. I'm much obliged to you, my dear. Much obliged to you.
Mr. James.
Eh?
These two.
What about them?
She's done a wrong thing. But recollect, you all profit by it. You don't disdain, any of you, to profit by it. Try to make their lives a little easier for them.
Easier?
Happier. You can influence the others, if you will. Will you?
I will try, Miss Thornhill. But, Tad, see you in the morning. See you in the morning. Phyllis, see you both in the morning. Goodbye, old girl.
Helen, you're leaving tomorrow. I'll keep out of your way. I'll keep upstairs to my room till you've gone.
Mr. Thaddeus, there's no reason why I should put your wife to that trouble. It's equally convenient for me to return to London this evening. Will you kindly ask Kate to pack me?
Certainly.
That's all, I think.
I wish you every happiness, Miss Thornhill. I wish you every happiness.
Oh, Mr. Ted. Mr. Ted, I propose that we allow 6 months to pass in complete silence. 6 months from today...
6 months? Silence?
I mean, without hearing from your wife. Then, perhaps she'll send me another invitation.
Invitation?
By that time, we shall all of us have forgotten a great deal, shan't we? You'll say that to her for me?
God bless you.
Fine, Kate.
Miss Thornhill, my wife, you've seen her at a disadvantage, a terrible disadvantage. She's a splendid woman, a splendid woman, a splendid wife and mother. They haven't appreciated her. The family haven't appreciated her. They've treated her abominably. For 16 years, she's been treated abominably. But I've never regretted my marriage. Never for a single moment. Never regretted it.
During the past hour, you have listened to the first performance on the air of Sir Arthur Wing Canaro's The Thunderbolt, written in the year 1909. The Thunderbolt was adapted for great plays by Charles Newton. Our cast, James Mortimer, Edward Jepson, Stephen Mortimer, Stanley Harrison, Thaddeus Mortimer, William Podmore, Phyllis, his wife, Era Gerald, Colonel Ponting, Eustace Wyatt, Rose, his wife, Joan Warburton, Helen Thornhill, Patricia Calvert, Mr. Valance, Philip Tong, and Mr. Elkin, Alfred Shirley. A Great Plays drama guide by Blevins Davis, who arranged for the series, is available to our radio audience at the cost of 25 cents. Send coin or money orders to Great Plays, National Broadcasting Company, New York City. The Great Plays drama guide contains a summary of the plot, sketch of the author's life, and pertinent facts about each of the 30 plays in this series. Consult your local library for reading material on the remaining Great Plays of the series. Next Sunday's production will be Rosmer's Home, by the great Norwegian dramatist Henrik Ibsen. This program has been presented as a public service by the National Broadcasting Company and the Independent Radio Station.